The population of monarch butterflies reached a historic low in the winter of 2013, and many people thought it might spell the end for this beautiful species. But there may be some good news for the monarchs this year. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. According to the World Wildlife Fund, this year, as they congregated in Mexico at the southern end of their migration, monarch butterflies covered 10 acres, an area more than three times as large as last year. This hour, I'll talk with entomologist Donald Lewis and people who are working to increase monarch butterfly habitat in Iowa. But to start the hour, a conversation with Carrie Byron, former host of MythBusters on the Discovery Channel. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The monarch butterfly may be in the midst of a comeback. We'll find out more about that later this hour. But first, Carrie Byron describes herself as an artist, a science geek, and a mom. You may know her from the 10 years she spent as part of the B team or the build team on the series MythBusters on the Discovery Channel. She's also the host of the Science Channel's Head Rush and Thrill Factor on the Travel Channel. She's speaking at 11:30 this morning at Des Moines Area Community College's part of Celebrate Innovation Week, and she is here with me now. Hello, Carrie.
Hi. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to start with that artist part, because you started your career as a sculptor, so help me connect the dots. How did you get from there to MythBusters?
Okay, well, I am a sculptor, but the passion that I was trying to get into was special effects, you know, the practical kind of special effects. I saw the making of Thriller when I was a kid, and I just wanted to make monsters or be Jim Henson. And so I got a job I got an internship at a special effects prop shop, which was Jamie Heineman's shop, the other host of MythBusters. And it just turns out my first day was the first day they started filming MythBusters. And I got pushed in front of the camera, and, you know, it was supposed to be my day job while I was a sculptor on the side, and it kind of switched. Now TV's my day. It's my day job.
So in all of the things that you did on MythBusters over the years, and the work that you're doing now, you're looking at all of these different things through a scientific lens. As an artist, where do you see the intersection between art and science?
Oh, I think they're one and the same. They used to be thought of as almost the sort of same, you know, journey through curiosity. I mean, in the parlors in the olden days, they would show you scientific tricks as you would look at a beautiful painting. It's all just questions and trying to find answers.
You know, it's interesting. Shows like MythBusters, a lot of people get really excited about them because they're easy to get excited about, and they hope that kids will get excited and want to explore more science. And I think it's interesting that there's sort of this push and pull between science, technology, engineering, and math in school and the arts, which tend to get cut year after year. So as an artist who's also a science geek, how do you feel about that?
I'm one of the people that tries change STEM to STEAM, because I believe that different disciplines will help you come up with better answers. You know, art is a different way of thinking. And I have a long, long-distance relationship, Ada Lovelace, who they believe was the beginning of computer science and invented the algorithm. She was the daughter of a poet, and her father was sort of a philanderer, so the mom tried to cure her of poetry by teaching her mathematics, and that beautiful combination of poetry and mathematics got her to figure out the answer to the problem with Charles Babbage's differential thinking machine. So I think that if you can learn science and art, you will be a better thinker. That was a long explanation.
Yeah,
sorry.
But no,
lots
that was great.
This morning, so much coffee.
And what is that doing to your body? Wait, we'll explore that another time. So with shows like you've been involved in, I know that people do think, oh, when kids see this, you know, maybe they will start asking questions about their world and looking at it in a scientific way. On the other hand, we also see you getting to blow stuff up and set stuff on fire and smash things. And that's really, really fun. Do you feel like that the message of we need to ask questions about the science behind this also gets through beyond all of the fun explosions and things like that?
I don't know. I'm just having fun. Kids are naturally curious. They're already going to ask questions. So if you pepper in a little bit of science, I always like to say it's when you put science on TV, it's like putting cheese sauce on broccoli. Like they love the cheese sauce, and if they eat the broccoli, awesome.
Now, on MythBusters, you were part of the B team, and so there were the two main hosts, and then there was the B team. There were three of you, and as that, you look at that group, you kind of stand out because, of course, you were the only woman on the show. How did that work for you? Was that ever an issue?
Only when I was pregnant, because then I got treated a little differently. But, you know, you kind of want to.
Right. You have to take some safety precautions.
I just didn't think of myself as the girl. I was just one of the team, you know. It never was an issue unless it came to trying to get porta potties on set, because men can pee in the nature a lot more easily than I can.
Have you heard from a lot of women over the years, though, that saw you on that show and were moved by that?
I have, and it's been such an honor to hear that sort of thing, because, you know, a lot of little girls grew up watching me on TV, and I didn't really have many role models on TV that weren't rock stars, or if there was a doctor show, they were always the nurse. I never really got to see any sciencey role models. So for me, it's quite an honor, and I feel like things have really changed. There's a lot more women on TV.
Now, you are also a mom, and I know that you have a daughter. Do you have just one child?
Just one.
Okay. And so when you think about the things that she'll get to grow up seeing on television, what do you hope she gets to see?
You know, I hope she doesn't even watch that much television, quite honestly. I'm kidding. No. I hope she gets to see role models that she can emulate, absolutely. But right now we're still at the stage of, like, Star Wars. So, you know, we haven't really gotten there yet.
Well, speaking of Star Wars, though, with the new Star Wars, which she may be a little young for.
Nope, she's so into Rey.
Yeah.
She's walking around with a lightsaber. She's so into it.
That's really cool. So right now, the final season of MythBusters is airing. And of course, you left the show in 2014. They went back to the original format of the show with just the two hosts. As the final season of the show is airing, what are your thoughts about it being over?
You know, everything comes to an end. They had a long, long run. You know, it was pretty epic, and it left a great legacy, and it opened a lot of doors for me. I am still doing lots of television. I'm filming a show with Grant and Tori right now that I'm not allowed to tell you where it's going to be or what it's about, but it's awesome.
And can you tell us what channel it's going to be on?
I can't.
Wow.
But it's all in the beginning works, but it's still exploring curiosity, I can tell you that.
Now, you are in Iowa as part of Innovation Week at DMAC, Des Moines Area Community College. What are you going to be talking about today?
This kind of stuff. Anything anybody asks. I'm kind of leaving it open to questions and letting the people watching are going to kind of lead the conversation.
So when you talk to audiences, I'm sure they have a lot of questions about things that they've seen you do on television. Can you tell me about one of your favorite experiments?
Oh, goodness, there's so many. I mean, I really loved any of the historical myths we did, because we would find them in old textbooks and, you know, so things like that. So I really liked doing, like, we had this, it's kind of esoteric, but we had this myth from 400 BC where there was an early warning detection system for people tunneling towards your castle, where you would bury a drum 30 feet down and then put people with good ears above it to try to hear if you could hear someone tunneling towards you. And when we actually proved it plausible, everybody was so shocked that it worked that, you know, it was really fun to feel like we had brought a piece of history and kind of proven that it was true. And it seemed so ridiculous.
Now, of course, the name of the show is MythBusters. So it's kind of implied that on the show, you would be taking a lot of these ideas and proving them wrong. Which did you prefer? Did you like busting myths or did you like reinforcing them?
Oh, I liked both. I mostly liked when I was wrong because there's that feeling of changing your mind and that fluidity that I think is very scientific that I really enjoyed. So I think Mythbusters just sounded like a better title than Myth Maybe Prove It.
Well, that's something to think about for a future show, maybe.
Maybe.
What was the scariest thing you ever did on the show?
Oh, we did some pretty crazy stuff. But when we went diving with sharks at night, I got really, really freaked out because when they turned out the lights, you didn't know what was around you, and you're already in these really claustrophobic masks. And I felt what I thought was a shark swim right by my head, and I screamed so loud I was blowing out the speakers inside the microphone in my mask, and it turned out it was a turtle. I turned a flashlight around on it. It was like, ah! Oh. But it was somewhat terrifying.
So being on the show and the other shows that you've been involved with as well, I mentioned Head Rush and Thrill Factor, Head Rush on Science Channel and Thrill Factor on Travel Channel. Does it change how you look around the world and just live day to day when you're constantly involved in trying to look at the science behind the things that we interact with every day?
I mean, I've always been a bit of a skeptic and I've always sort of enjoyed that kind of thing. So I don't know if it's changed me or I've just kind of grown into it because it's been over a decade that's the way that I'm looking at the world, that I think it's become part of me.
And do you find yourself just with friends and family constantly explaining things?
Well, I've got a six-year-old that says, why, why, why? So yes, all the time. Google is my best friend.
What, I know you can't tell us about your next TV project, but can you tell us about other things you're working on? What does the future hold?
Well, we're developing a show with Steve Wozniak that hopefully will end up on air at some point, which is about tech. I'm doing the show with Tori and Grant, and then we've got some other ones in the works, but that's quite a lot right there. That, and I'm still doing a lot of sculpture. I'm working on a children's book.
Oh, that's exciting. And are you surprised at how much people still want to talk to you about Mythbusters?
Well, that's one of the more interesting things about me, so sure, I like it. I'm not really that surprised. It's been on the air for so long, and it's going on to Science Channel, into syndication forever. So I think it will kind of be around and part of the conversation for a long time.
All right. So even if it's part of your past, it's part of the present and the future for the rest of us, huh?
Yes. So, you know, it's funny because these old episodes pop up and I look at how young I look or, you know, how different I look from back in the day. And it's so present.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Carrie Byron is an artist and a television host. She's been a part of Mythbusters on the Discovery Channel, Science Channel's Head Rush, Thrill Factor on the Travel Channel, and many more future programs and projects to come. She'll be speaking this morning at 11:30 at Des Moines Area Community College as part of Celebrate Innovation Week. Coming up in just a moment, we've had some good news about the monarch butterfly this year. That's after years of bad news about the monarch butterfly. So we'll take a look at what this news actually means about the future of this beautiful species in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. According to the World Wildlife Fund, this year, as monarch butterflies congregated in Mexico at the southern end of their migration, they covered 10 acres of land. That's an area more than three times as large as last year. Now, that's nowhere near the 45 acres monarch butterflies covered in the winter months of 1996, but it's a lot more than the 1.66 acres they covered at their all-time population low in 2013. To help us understand what all of this means, of course, we turn to Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And help me put this in perspective. What does this news mean?
This news is good news. We're excited to have something good to talk about monarch butterflies. It also reminds us of how little we know. There are huge issues around understanding every ecological system. Whether it's people or panda bears or monarch butterflies, it's this huge puzzle that we may understand a little piece of. We may have data at one end of the cycle, but not a lot of data at the other end of the cycle. So we're going to enjoy the good news, but we're also going to realize we aren't real sure why the population went down. We've got a lot of theories. We're not real sure why it's come up for 2 years. So as much as anything to a scientist, this means we still have a lot more questions to answer.
Now, of course, there are a lot of monarch butterfly enthusiasts in Iowa, but for those who haven't necessarily gotten on the bandwagon yet, let's revisit the migration of this species, because it's such an amazing journey, an amazing story for these delicate, delicate creatures. What happens every year to monarch butterflies?
They look so fragile. They are almost paper thin, and here they are fluttering through our lives, and we recognize monarch butterflies. They're a popular butterfly. Lots of children have raised them as school projects and let them go in September. And all of the monarchs that we produce here in the upper Midwest, all the way up into southern Canada, on this side of the Rocky Mountains, we'll refer to that as the eastern United States monarch population, they all, by the beginning of September and on into the beginning of October, take off on a southward migration, and they will fly 2,000 to 3,000 miles to reach a particular forest ecosystem in south-central Mexico. And that migration alone just makes them spectacular, that those monarchs that we raised and enjoyed up here would not survive if they stayed in Iowa in the winter. Sort of like some of us. We think we wouldn't survive if we stayed here for the winter, so we're going to get out of here and go south. But every monarch that is going to make it to the next generation, make it to the next stage of their life, is going to have to get out of Iowa, have to get out of Canada, they have to get out of the upper Midwest, and they have to get to this place in south-central Mexico where they will find the humidity, the temperatures, and the habitat that will allow them to rest and wait for the next step of their life. So we recognize them, we enjoy them, we refer to them as jewels of the air, and then they just knock our socks off with this migration story, and you say, how can that be? How can they find their way? How can something so simple-looking, so fragile-looking make such a long trip? But yet they've been doing it for eons.
Now, for many years, we watched the population of monarch butterflies decline year after year until it hit that low in 2013. And, you know, I think you and I talked about monarch butterflies that year. I think you used the term, this is a species circling the drain. And, you know, there are a lot of things. We don't understand the whole system that has led to this crisis point for monarch butterflies, but we do know some things. So let's talk about what we do know. What has changed in our environment that has put monarchs at risk?
The survey you're referring to is the population in Mexico. And this has been the standard since it was started in 1993. What we're doing is we're looking at the adult population, the adult stage of a complex life cycle that has reached a hibernation spot, an overwintering spot. So these are the ones that have been successful and have reached to that point. That may not be the best way to measure populations, but it's certainly been the standard for a long period of time.
Well, it's nice when they all get together like that. It's a convenient place to take a measure.
And that's it. It's an easy way to measure them compared to when they're spread out over the entire eastern United States and southern Canada. How do you count the population in the summer? Well, when they all get together in Mexico, you can define the area much more easily and we get those population counts. So as we watch this decline happen, especially the decline that has occurred since 1996, we start to look around and say, what all's been going on? Well, we know monarch butterflies, just like other insects, have diseases and predators and parasites. So there are natural causes for them to die. We also know that in some of those years of decline, they were severely challenged by droughts in the area where they feed, lay their eggs, and where their offspring grow and develop. So reproduction may have been hurt by some of the climate change, the droughts that we have seen. We also know they've been exposed to insecticides, that the new class of insecticides, the neonicotinoids that are now used largely throughout the Corn Belt, may have been a piece of it. But the one that we have focused on is the loss of milkweeds. And when monarchs lay their eggs, the females are very picky. They don't scatter their eggs randomly through the garden, through the fields, through the fence rows, and so forth. They will only lay their eggs on milkweeds because that's the only plant that their caterpillar, their offspring, can eat and survive on. So they're very picky where they lay their eggs, and we have watched milkweeds nearly vanish from the upper Midwest, especially through the Corn Belt, because of the development of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans, where we can spray fields with glyphosate herbicide and kill everything except the corn and soybeans, and the number of milkweeds in the upper Midwest has declined dramatically. Is it one of these things? No. Is it some combination of these things? Yes. And much of the focus has been on the loss of milkweeds because we know the milkweed is so important to the development of the monarch butterfly populations.
Well, and I think that a lot of us also focus on the milkweed because it's something we can actually have an impact on. I mean, I as an individual cannot probably have an impact on neonicotinoids in the environment if that's part of the puzzle, but I can plant milkweed.
And you can't change the weather. You can't stop droughts in Texas and other areas where this has happened. We also cannot do much individually. We can't do much directly to stop deforestation in Mexico, that there are threats to the area, these forests of south central Mexico where the monarchs congregate. There are also weather extremes down there, windstorms, ice storms, rainstorms that hurt the monarchs. We can't change deforestation in Mexico, though we can contribute to organizations that are trying. We can't change the weather. We can't really stop urban development, which has eliminated much of our farmland, much of our prairie is gone, much of our meadows and pastures are gone, because we're still building shopping centers, we're still building apartments. We're not going to stop that. You and I aren't going to change intensive farming. The people who are making those decisions are making them for their reasons, for it's largely profit-driven, based on the price of commodities and so forth. So there are lots of things we can't control, but you're absolutely right. The one thing I can do is plant milkweeds. I can put up a little sign that says, I have planted milkweeds. What have you done to help the monarchs? So we have focused on that in much of our educational efforts, encouraging people to plant more milkweeds, let them grow in the roadsides and ditches, let them grow at the edge of the fields, let them grow in your garden.
So I know you've given a great deal of thought to this. What do you think the most important factor is?
Oh, I still come down on the milkweed part of it. I keep looking at all these other things and saying each one has a part and it may be different in different years. But as we look at the long-term trend and certainly as we look at the data that was collected through research here at Iowa State University, the milkweed populations in fields declined 81% from 1999 to 2010. And this was a study done by a scientist here at Iowa State University and in Minnesota. So going out and looking at those fields and realizing there are no more milkweeds left. As a kid, I walked a lot of beans. I was a farm kid in Ohio. We didn't call it walking beans. We called it hoeing weeds. But one of the things we did was hoe milkweeds out of the fields because they were moderately common. Chip Taylor, the head of Monarch Watch, has been working with monarchs for decades now. He has come up with this estimate that back in the day, there were 40 to 50 milkweed stems per acre. And that sounds about right compared to the number that Uncle Ralph, Dad, and I had to hoe out of the fields. You know, I can believe that there were 40 to 50 milkweeds per acre out there. As we look at fields today, we see almost none. So that decline is visible to me in my lifetime. It's visible from the data that was collected between 1999 and 2010. So I come down on, yeah, milkweed is a big part of this. And maybe that's because I understand that part. I'm less sure what is the impact of neonicotinoids used as seed treatments in fields on monarch populations that come much later in the summer. In fact, I'm rather skeptical that there is much impact there. I don't see the deforestation of Mexico. So I'm not sure I understand that as well. I don't see droughts in Texas, so I really don't understand that part as well. So when people ask me, what do I think? I try to give the big picture, but to me, I keep coming back to milkweeds.
I'm talking with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. We're talking about monarch butterflies this hour. There has been some good news about the monarch butterfly population this year. It is bouncing back at least a little bit over the last couple of years from a historic low in 2013. And there are a lot of people in Iowa who are very concerned about monarch butterflies and want to do something to help. And a lot of that help has focused on milkweed. And Kelly Gilbo is one of those people. She is co-founder of the Ragbri Group, Milkweed Matters. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And tell me what the idea is behind, of course, Ragbri, the Register's annual grape bike ride across Iowa. So tell me what the idea is behind having a milkweed-themed Ragbri team.
Sure. Well, as Dr. Lewis mentioned, I agree that milkweed is the big issue here that at least everyone here in Iowa has some say in. And we, you know, there's a question, how can we plant milkweed in Iowa? And it seems like 17,000 people on bikes going across the state seems like a pretty easy way to get all that seed distributed.
Okay, so obviously you're not giving milkweed seeds to every single rider on Ragbri. How are you doing this?
Right. So the goal for this year's Ragbri ride is to make 35,000 seed balls. This is just a half part clay, half part soil, with maybe 3 to 5 common milkweed seeds in each seed ball. And there's a variety of different ways that we give these out, primarily in one town each day along the ride. We're going to have an educational booth where obviously lots of information will be given out, lots of advocacy. We'll have actual monarchs that are being raised. It's perfect time for the breeding time. So riders can come up and get one or two seed balls, and then as they ride off, just toss it from their bike.
Now, you have done some trial and error with this. You rode first a couple of years ago with the idea that you could do something to plant milkweeds. How did you try the first year?
Right. So my roommate at the time and I had actually just moved to Iowa and had an interest in monarchs before that. But once I moved here, really understood that, you know, I was in the middle of the migration. It was really a hot topic here in Iowa, and I felt compelled to get more involved than just knowing about it. So we signed up for Ragbri because that's what you do when you're new to Iowa. And we sort of thought, how can we do more than just we didn't just want to ride our bikes 400 miles. we wanted to contribute or give back some way. So sort of inspired by the whole Johnny Appleseed idea, we had some loose seeds, which are very light, like most seeds, and we thought that we could just sort of toss it as we rode, just the seeds themselves, and obviously those blew in the wind. We put some seeds in little paper packets and thought that those would sort of be heavy enough to toss from the bikes, but they also were too light, and they also sort of looked like litter, which, of course, is the opposite of what we wanted to do. So immediately we scratched that idea, and we had to sort of get off of our bikes every few minutes, and we would tear open the packet and plant the seeds and then recycle the packet later. But so the following year, which was last year's Ragbri, we worked extensively with another group that I'm sort of also a member of, Monarchs in Eastern Iowa, which is a group of hundreds of monarch enthusiasts in the eastern side of the state. And we made 2,000 seed balls. And so the mix of clay and dirt really weighs it down. It's very easy to toss from the bike. And there's also the benefit of the clay and the soil sort of protects the seed from wind and predators and birds and all of those things that might affect the seed. So then it's ready to come up and germinate and go through its cold, moist stratification process as it needs to. So it works much better now.
Have you tested them out to make sure that they're germinating?
Well, that's sort of the big thing that's a priority these days, is to really look at the effectiveness of it all. I mean, it's certainly been a pilot so far to even see if this is something that can work, if people get excited about it. I think there was so much energy last year around it that we know that people want to be involved. And so at this point, definitely for this year, we're thinking through, you know, I think before maybe early summer, I'm going to drive the Ragbri route and kind of take pictures of the route pre-seed ball.
Oh, and then you'll go back and check it out later.
Yeah, maybe see in the next spring.
But it strikes me that the education part of this is the most important part.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what gets me most excited about it. The conversations that happen during the week are incredible and inspiring and heartbreaking. And, you know, it's a whole roller coaster of emotions throughout the week. But everyone has their story. You know, they'll come to the educational booth, or even while we're riding, they'll sort of pedal up next to me and tell me their whole story. During the ride, I wear some Monarch wings, and so I'm sort of easily noticeable in the crowd.
Nice.
The conversations are the best part. Folks come, as you know, from all over the states, sometimes even internationally, for Ragbri. So lots of times they'll ask, how can I, you know, I have a garden back in Virginia or Texas or wherever. How can I get involved back home?
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Kelly Gilbo is one of the people who co-founded the Ragbri group Milkweed Matters. They'll be scattering milkweed seeds all along the Ragbri route this summer, as they have done in summers past. We're going to continue talking about the monarch butterfly with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. There's been some good news about the monarch butterfly population released this week. The World Wildlife Fund reported that as they congregated in Mexico at the southern end of their migration route, monarch butterflies covered 10 acres of land this year. That's more than three times as large as last year, much larger than their historic low of 1.66 acres in 2013. Although, as we've been talking about this hour, it's still a very small population compared to what we have seen in the past, and it doesn't mean that the threats to the monarch butterfly are over by any means. With me this hour, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. You are also welcome to join our conversation with your questions, your concerns, your observations. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Donald, we were just talking about an effort to throw milkweed seeds out along the Ragbri route. I know there are lots of groups in the state of Iowa that are growing milkweed seedlings to sell at garden sales in the springtime, and people are planting butterfly gardens and making sure that they have milkweed in their own yard. How much of a movement do you see this as being right now? We hear a lot about it, but maybe I'm here inside this Hort Day Talk of Iowa bubble.
Well, aren't we all? There's a lot of interest, and there's a lot of diverse groups, everybody from the Ragbri riders to the garden clubs to others. The thing about milkweed is we're not always talking about just one milkweed. There are a dozen different kinds of milkweeds we could plant. They are native to Iowa. Common milkweed is the one we think of, the one with the 5 to 6 foot tall stems and the big oval leaves. But those of us with gardens have known for a long time, and the prairie enthusiasts have known, there's this other milkweed called butterfly milkweed that has these beautiful orange flowers, which complements your sunny garden border, your perennial garden, if you have enough sun to grow this prairie plant. So there are different species of milkweeds we could be planting. One that has proved popular and easy to grow and easy to transplant is the swamp milkweed. So Iowa State University is researching this. Others around the state are researching. Others around the country are in on this. And many of them have been at it longer than we have. So there's tremendous interest right now. This is a popular insect. It's a popular topic. People want to do what they can to help, and planting milkweeds is one of those things they can do.
Tom is on the line from Mason City. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, and you're concerned about spraying in the roadside ditches and people trying to plant milkweed, but then tell me what you've observed.
Well, I'm in Cerro Gordo County, and I know a large part of their budget is weed killing. They spray the ditches, despite a lot of us try to stop them. But so the gal, I love her efforts with the ragbri thing, but if they're planting in the roadside ditches, I'm sure other counties do the same thing. It's pressure from the Farm Bureau. One of the questions I have for somebody in the know, if they're going to soak the crops with Roundup anyway, why are they concerned about weeds in the roadside ditches? We've been fighting this. I and some others have been trying to fight the county conservation to stop this spraying, but they're getting so much pressure from the Farm Bureau to do this. And so the efforts of this gal and the ragbri people may be nixed by the county conservation. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand it. If the Roundup is going to kill the weeds out in the field, why do they care if there's weeds growing in the ditches?
Oh, Tom, thank you so much for bringing that up, because I know that's a concern a lot of people have. And I know, Donald, you can't speak for all of the decisions that are made, but this is a controversial subject in a lot of counties in Iowa.
It exactly is. And an entomologist is not your best source to talk about the political will of county boards of directors and others who are making these decisions. But as we look along the interstate highway, we know what this living roadside effort has done. They have brought prairie plants to the sides of the interstate highways and other state roads. So we know there are movements in this direction. Going back to my experience as an Ohio farm kid 50 years ago, killing weeds on the roadside was what Dad did when there wasn't anything else to do on the farm. The crops were planted, the hay was baled, the cultivation was done, we were waiting for harvest. So we would fill the time by killing weeds alongside the road, and the township would come through and spray. I assume it was 2,4-D. They would spray it to kill the vegetation, the trees that were growing in the roadsides. So much of this is tradition, and much of it is sort of this fear that, well, if there are weeds next to me, I'll have weeds. But Tom's exactly right. There are discussions that should be had on this, and there are inroads being made to save some of this roadside vegetation, and it's a concern and a discussion that's going to have to continue.
Well, and again, I'm not an expert on this either, although I live in Johnson County, where there has been a change in how roadside ditches are managed. And in addition to not spraying, there's also a rule about not mowing early in the season. And that makes a big difference, too. I mean, mowing is going to take out the milkweed as well, right?
Sure. Anything that cuts down that vegetation, whether it's herbicide or mowing, will impact those milkweeds. The milkweeds aren't killed by mowing, but they're certainly not as large as they would have been by the time the monarchs get here, sort of in May and the rest of the summer when they're looking for those milkweeds alongside the road. So, yes, I think my vague recollection is the mowing rule relates to wildlife nesting habitat. I can't remember if it's birds or which one it is, but yes, we have these rules. We have the changes that have taken place. More changes are needed if we're going to continue this effort.
Now, another thing that I've observed, and we've talked about on the program in the past, is that when you buy, if you want to put in native grasses, when you buy a prairie mix of seeds, milkweed is often not a component of that. And the CRP mix that people have been planting over the years, milkweed has not been a component of that either. So is that something, I mean, people need to, if they're trying to put a natural area on their land, they need to make sure milkweed's a part of it, right?
And I think that's changing. It may be slow compared to what we might wish it to be, but NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, has the seed mix recommendations, and largely because of President Obama's initiative to help milkweeds, help monarchs by establishing milkweeds, those seeds can now be included. And CRP mixes that are planted by conservation boards may include that. And this is one of those things that as we talk about it, as we learn what we can do, it's something we can include. The problem is we have spent decades, most of us have spent our entire life hating milkweed because, quote, it is a weed. It's got weed right in its name. Why would we like that plant? Well, now we have to change our thinking, and it may be slower for some people than others to come around to the point that, oh, just because I call it a weed in one place, in the middle of my field, doesn't mean it's a weed in other places. And so everything has its value in its right place, and this is an example of that. So seed mixes can include milkweed. You can include milkweed in your garden plans. You can include milkweeds in other parts of the state. And these are attitudes that are slowly changing, and in some places faster than others.
Now, with milkweed, there are so many species that depend on sort of habitat corridors, making sure that places with habitat connect to other places with habitat. With monarch butterflies, does that matter? Is it okay if I plant milkweed in the middle of nowhere where there's no other milkweed?
Fragmentation of ecosystems has always been an issue, and what little bit of research we have gathered from Iowa State University, working with our USDA partners and working with our outlying research farms, we've started to look at this question. If I have a milkweed in a meter of pasture, or if I have 5 milkweeds in that meter of pasture, or if I have 10 milkweeds in that meter of pasture, meter square, does it make a difference? And our preliminary evidence is no, it probably didn't. So monarchs must find milkweed, and they are very well attuned to it. The perpetuation of the species depends on the female butterfly's ability to pick milkweed out of everything else and to keep looking until she finds it. So we know they will find isolated milkweeds, but corridors are certainly an important part of it. And in the fall, the butterflies need corridors of blooming plants so they can fuel up, get a little 5-hour energy drink by sipping nectar from flowers along the way on their path to Mexico. So a corridor at that time of year may actually be more important than a corridor of milkweeds. But these are the kinds of questions that, maybe we should have been asking these questions 20 years ago. And in certain parts of the country, they were asking them 20 years ago. We started asking them 2 years ago.
This is from Joe in Boone County. He says, we see monarch eggs and small caterpillars, but they're gone before they form chrysalis. Are there predators that will eat monarch caterpillars?
Monarchs, like all the other insects, are subject to diseases, predators, and parasites. So it may not be a predator. And milkweeds, monarchs are fairly well protected from most predators. A bird that eats a monarch that has sequestered the chemicals from the milkweed, that bird will spend the rest of the day going pff, 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 because it tasted so terrible. So it's probably not as much predators as it is pathogens and parasites, that these are things that are happening inside that we don't see. But there's a huge loss of monarch caterpillars from the time the female lays her egg until that egg hatches into a caterpillar, the caterpillar turns into a chrysalis, and the chrysalis turns into a butterfly. And this is typical of all insects. If all insects reproduce to their maximum potential, we would be up to our armpits in insects. And as you think about monarchs and other insects, that female needs to have 2 offspring survive to adulthood for success. If she replaces herself and if she replaces the male that mated with her, it will be a steady population. It will stay the same. More than 2 offspring per female and the population grows. So of the dozens of eggs that may be laid, if only 2 of them make it, that was really success. And that's true of all insects as we think about them. And it's also true as we think about planting milkweeds. If the thousands of milkweed seeds per milkweed plant all grew, there would be no question there would be plenty of milkweed. The one estimate from Monarch Watch is that 80% of milkweed seeds fail. So 20% success is actually pretty high when you think about all those seeds that are out there. So high failure rates are typical. It's what we have to overcome. It's what the insects overcome to perpetuate their species. But the Boone Inquirer is exactly right. There's a high loss of caterpillars during that development time.
Dave is on the line from Muscatine. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Just a question is, for years, we have about 2.25 acres in Muscatine, and we're a mile from the Discovery Center, which has got tons of milkweed in it. And for years, I've been trying to pick up half a dozen or a dozen pods and spread them around on the edge of our woods without success. So I wonder if you could put on your website how you put together these seed balls. I'd like, you know, we've observed monarchs flying through our property for more so years ago than currently, but in the fall particularly, it was really beautiful just watching continuous stream of monarchs flying through, as if they knew where the Discovery Center was.
Well, Dave, that's a great question, and I know some people have a really hard time growing milkweed, and Donald, you're an entomologist, not a horticulturist. But
not an agronomist. Growing plants isn't my specialty. Raising the insects that will eat your plant is one of the things I know. But agronomists and horticulturists are sort of struggling with this, and part of it is this high failure of seed, and the specialists who are producing milkweed plugs or milkweed plants are growing these seeds in the greenhouse ahead of time where they can create ideal conditions of potting mix and moisture levels and light levels. And we can up that success rate under those controlled conditions. But scattering milkweed seeds the way nature does is there's going to be a high failure rate, sort of like scattering acorns the way squirrels do. There's a high failure rate. So nature doesn't let everything grow. It sets some limits on things, and we can overcome that by controlling the conditions in a greenhouse. Otherwise, we're going to just have to take what we can get.
We're nearly out of time, and I want to ask you, monarch butterflies are an insect that just inspire so many of us. They are so beautiful. They're easy to identify. They're iconic. We want to do something to help them. But when we see the monarch butterfly population decline as it has, it makes me think about all of the other species that we're not looking at, that we don't see. And planting milkweed is one thing, but what can we be doing to support other important species that we're not looking at?
The same one-word answer I've given when you've asked me similar questions in the past, and that is biodiversity, that we should be establishing wide varieties of plants. We should be having violets in our prairies. We should have all these prairie plants that used to be here. We need to bring those back as we can, but you're exactly right. The monarch butterfly is iconic. It's a charismatic insect. It's one that we know enough about to know a little bit about what needs to be done, but that's one down and maybe 19,999 other species in Iowa to go to think about what do they need and what are they not getting. A positive note, though, is monarchs have recovered in Mexico to a certain extent, the overwintering population. The summer populations seem to be able to rebound, and that's good news that we still see monarchs in our upper Midwest area. But like the caller from Muscatine mentioned, seeing those steady migrations, seeing those huge populations in the month of September, that may be the part that we're going to miss in the future for the near term. So those grand migrations may be gone, but the species is not going extinct. And so I think there's some good news to end with, that it's not all bad news. It's not going to be the end of the monarchs as we know them, but they do need a little more help from us.
Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. And of course, you often hear him on Horticulture Day. We'll have Horticulture Day on the air on Friday. And now that it's March, we are back to weekly Horticulture Days. Spring is here, at least on the radio. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Follow us on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Charity Nebbe. You can also follow Iowa Public Radio on Facebook as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.